A poet from California's wine country who transplanted herself in New York City for over a decade, Ada Limón talks about her three books of poetry that join both coasts.
I want my poetry to help people reconnect to the world or recommit to the world, to inspire them to stay here. Life is hard, but it's hard for all of us, and we're all in it together.
Ada Limón also discusses how copywriting for magazines helps her creative life on this edition of New Letters on the Air, a production of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Ada Limón with one of her earliest award-winning poems.
Miles Per Hour is a poem I wrote in a small little apartment I had in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and I think at the time I was remembering this moment of really seeing myself as separate from the valley that I lived in and as separate from my parents and as separate from the people I was most connected to. So this is a poem about that. Miles per hour. The painted tiles are riddled with blue cornflowers and unnaturally green stems, as unnatural as trying to concentrate on the blossoms covering the bathroom walls. The way when we were driving 66 miles per hour and each lupin had become not one, but rather one massive stain of purple and blue, like one large bruise covering the right side of Highway 12. And the more I tried to find one leaf, one petal, the more dizzy I became, until the search for something simple had ruined its way into nausea, into that throbbing in the middle of my eyes, when we knew it was over, all of it, and yet we were still in the car, still going to meet the family. And when we pulled over on Old Sonoma Road under the tree to make love once more, before the parental handshake made love more difficult, more permanent. My head swelled, not knowing whether or not to hold on to the handle or the stick shift, or to shove my foot on the dashboard, or just to remain pinned like that. Pummeled in the car seat, what we called screwing, the hard stuff, the times when we were more angry than anything else, the turn on being the pain. And through the car window, I could see everything in summer heat. The oak leaves the tires had crushed in their masculine heaviness, the fungus that grew on the side of the tree, making a shape like a face or a birthmark, and each single thing made me grab you harder, want to be connected to something larger, as if we could swell into the universe itself, the movement of hips propelling us up into some, I don't want to say celestial body, but something as big as that. Where we could watch over everything, the towns growing smaller like little painted toys, those giant oaks and cedars turning into a brushstroke of blue and green, small and unrecognizable as these flowers now, painted haphazardly and scattered, like the memory itself. The car driving farther and farther down the highway, my face pressed up against the window, unable to discern whether or not I was as much of a blur as the things I passed.
That's the poem Miles Per Hour, which was originally entitled The Highway and was the 2003 winner of the Chicago Literary Award for Poetry and is published in Ada Limón's first book, Lucky Wreck. This is New Letters on the Air. That's a powerful poem, dealing with our own human physical needs and yet being aware of the outside and maybe how we blend in with the natural world. And I know you're from Northern California. That is such a wonderful world to be outside. And yet you lived for 11 years in New York City. Do you think that helped push out these poems?
Absolutely. All three books really deal with that disconnectedness to nature and wanting to feel that animal return to the natural world, and yet also loving the vibrancy and the energy and that wonderful community that New York City provides. And I think that in the most recent book, I explore it even more and really come into that idea of the disconnectedness or dislocation, if you will. So it's definitely something that I believe helped me write all the poems that I've written in New York.
I always think when you're removed from an environment, that makes the environment that you've left behind so much more vivid in a way, because there's a longing for that.
Absolutely. I think that being homesick is a wonderful state to write in. There's this amber quality to memories or to a home that you remember or your childhood or your first love. And I think that that can really add this wonderful separation when you're trying to remember it and then also being in the room that you're writing now. And that idea of those worlds colliding really can form an energetic poem, if you're careful enough to at least remember it with as much detail and as heart as you can.
Yeah.
Miles Per Hour is one of the few poems that I wrote in graduate school at NYU. You always think when you do your thesis as a graduate student in creative writing that all of your poems that you write during graduate school will become your first book. And then it turns out that maybe one or two survive and make it into your first book.
And is that what happened with you?
Yeah, only a few of them survived into the first manuscript. And I always tell that to graduate students because there's so much pressure on the thesis and they think, oh, this is going to be my book. And, you know, I'm not sure if I love all the poems. It's like, well, I think that's good. And if you don't love all the poems, then write a different book and let that be your thesis and grow from there.
That's good advice, I think. What year did you move to New York City?
99.
So were you in the city for 9/11?
I was not. I was in L.A. I was traveling with the poet Jimmy Santiago Baca, who was doing a reading there that night, but then was canceled, obviously. And then I was on the very first flight out of L.A. into New York. My plane was entirely firemen.
Oh, wow.
And me, sort of sandwiched between these two big guys, and it was a pretty remarkable flight. So I was there in the city, I think, 2 days afterwards, and then immediately went down to Ground Zero, and all of us made meatloafs and brought food for everyone who were their first responders. I think it was just such a momentous, destructive occasion, but it did bring that city so close together that it was also a remarkable experience for the city as a community. Mm-hmm. Everyone really, really got close together in a way that I think only those kind of tragedies can do.
Exactly. One of your poems refers to being in a bar with a bunch of firemen. Did that have anything to do with that?
That was written after it. So yes, we used to hang out at a bar called the Turkey's Nest. I spent probably 6 years there. We had small apartments in New York, so oftentimes your local bar is like your living room. And they became our community. We didn't know anyone. We were two girls coming from the West Coast, my friend Trish and I. And they really became our family. You know, there were cops and firemen and the local Brooklyn boys that hung out at this place. And it was a really amazing experience for a West Coast girl to come into the East Coast world.
It's such a strange little poem. Maybe we should have you read it.
Sure. This poem is a lot about being a poet as well. The firemen are dancing. I am running my finger through the rough, knotted hole on the edge of the stained oak bar table. It looks like it could be an eye hole, and I think it would be the scariest thing in the world if I were an ant. A hole where the bottom drops out, just like that, onto the floor. I don't want to drink tonight. Or if I do, I want to drink a lot. Enough to lie down on the ash-blackened floor and watch everything through the eyehole. Everyone is talking about parties. The vice cop keeps looking at the guy we call Red, and that's fine by me because I don't like him. Never have. Oh, and the firemen are dancing. My favorite part is how they are dancing so close. One is pulling the other to his hip, and the one with the hat is laughing and tossing his head back as if they were 17, or even as if they were alone. And it's okay that I don't have a specific you right now. And it's okay that I'm not sure who this you I'm speaking to is anymore. The firemen are dancing. And one of them has leaned his head on the other's blue shoulder, and the ones at the window are singing and watching with big, lovely fireman smiles. And it's okay that you weren't here to see it. I'm going to tell you all about it, even if you never ask. I will.
That's called The Firemen Are Dancing from the collection Lucky Wreck. And Ada Limon wrote that one after spending some years in New York City. And you said it's about writing poetry. Elaborate on that.
Well, I think when we write, we're always trying to connect with someone. And we have that ideal reader in our head, or we have our family and friends that we know at least they'll read it. So I think this poem has a lot to do with finding out who you're writing to and knowing that you are always writing to someone. And it's that need to share these stories, our own personal histories, our own personal mythology, all the things that become important to us, a small moment in time. Just a girl watching firemen dance in a bar became something essential to my life. And hopefully something small like that can become a universal thing. In that way, this poem is really about reaching out and making sure that you're sharing those stories that are important.
You went for your MFA at NYU, and you studied with lots of people, Sharon Olds, Marie Howe, Mark Doty, Galway Connell, and U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine. Talk a little bit about Phil Levine, because I know you liked his work from the beginning, because he is the working class poet.
Mm-hmm. Phil Levine was my first teacher at NYU, and he's also the reason I went to NYU. And so he was, you know, my very first poetry class. I was incredibly nervous, and he was so intense and such a personality and so harsh and firm about what he believed a poem could do and making us work towards the goal of creating a really, really good, solid poem. He did like my work. I was writing pretty narrative work, and I think he likes that. Then at one point, I started reading Kenneth Koch and started to explore my small wings as a poet and brought in this poem with all these long lines, and it had random numbers in it, and I really thought I was this experimental poet all of a sudden. And I read it, and there was silence, and he just hated it. And the poet Kazem Ali, who was also in my workshop, said, "But Phil, don't you think there's some beautiful lines in this poem?" And he said, "There are some beautiful lines. I just wish you'd put them in a poem." Yeah, he really taught me that, you know, you can play as much as you want, but at the end of the day, you better be writing a poem. So he was a great teacher. He was a hard teacher, but in a lot of ways, I think that first semester at NYU molded me into the poet I am today.
Well, your 2010 collection is called Sharks in the Rivers. The title poem kicks off the book and has a lot of nature references. How did you decide to go with sharks versus one of your many bird poems?
I wanted to have a sense of this continuity throughout the book that's different than the other two books. So I wanted this sense of the river, that every poem has this river running through it, that there's a pull, that there's a flow, there's a current. And then I needed this darkness. Even though there's a lot of light and there's a lot of going out into the universe with the bird references, and birds are incredibly important in this book, I needed that darkness and that sense of fear, because there are so many poems that deal with loss and with death and fear. And so I think that the sharks really, for me, became this present character that needed the title poem and then needed the title of the book.
Well, let's have you read that poem.
Sure. Sharks in the Rivers. We'll say unbelievable things to each other in the early morning, our blue coming up from our roots, our water rising in our extraordinary limbs. All night I dreamt of bonfires and burn piles and ghosts of men and spirits behind those birds of flame. I cannot tell any more when a door opens or closes. I can only hear the frame saying, "Walk through." It is a short walkway into another bedroom. Consider the handle. Consider the key. I say to a friend how scared I am of sharks, how I thought I saw them in the creek across from my street. I once watched for them holding a bundle of rattlesnake grass in my hand, shaking like a weak leaf girl. She sends me an article from a recent National Geographic that says sharks bite fewer people each year than New Yorkers do, according to Health Department records. Then she sends me on my way into the city of sharks. Through another doorway, I walk to the East River saying, sharks are people too. Sharks are people too. Sharks are people too. I write all the things I need on the bottom of my tennis shoes. I say, let's walk together. The sun behind me is like a fire, tiny flames in the river's ripples. I say something to God, but he's not a living thing. So I say it to the river. I say, I want to walk through this doorway, but without all those ghosts on the edge, I want them to stay here. I want them to go on without me. I want them to burn in the water.
Sharks in the Rivers. That's the title poem of the 2010 collection by Ada Limon, and she's with us here today on New Letters on the Air. There are several almost elegiac poems in here. Mm-hmm. I mean, tributes to people who have died. Mm-hmm. I think one's a tribute to a good friend of yours that mm-hmm. you had while you were in New York City who worked with you at Brides Magazine, is that right?
Yeah.
Before we get off on that poem, tell us a little bit about the kind of work that you did for the magazines.
Well, I moved to New York to get my degree in creative writing, and I also needed to make a living. So I started working for magazines at first on a freelance basis. I was also teaching in the schools, but eventually I started working for magazines more and more, and I worked for Martha Stewart magazines. I worked for Brides, Modern Bride magazine, GQ, Travel and Leisure, always on the marketing side. So I really got a feel of what it was like to work in the real corporate world of New York City, as well as meet some wonderful people that work for those magazines and work in Condé Nast and in Fairchild and those big publishing companies.
And it's interesting because you were working with language. I mean, you were a copywriter, mm-hmm. but in such a different way than doing your own creative work. It seems like that would be a wonderful balance.
I think it's great. I mean, I think people should explore it more. I think that, you know, a lot of people talk about the problems with so many MFA programs and that we're creating too many poets, which I think is such a funny thing to think that is a problem. I don't understand why too many poets would be a problem. But the problem really is that they come out with this false idea that they will go right into teaching poetry. And there's hardly any teaching positions. So people really need to know that if you have a talent or a gift for language, you can use that as a real business asset. Copywriting for me, it's a real playful and joyful way to spend my time as well as pay the rent. Coming up with fun headlines or even the puzzle of trying to get 6 selling points in a 10-word mission statement is not similar to writing poetry at all. It's a different part of your brain, but you do get to play with forms and challenge yourself with language every day, and that's a real pleasure.
And you're living now in Lexington, Kentucky,
yes.
and you're doing this copywriting mm-hmm. freelance.
I still freelance. I have a home office, and I'm working on a novel there. So when the work comes in, I drop everything and work for some great companies in New York. And then when it doesn't, I work full-time on the book.
Well, let's hear this one poem for Jess.
Marketing life for those of us left, for Jess. Stuck in the answer of day, all we've got are these people to rely on, and trees, and the grasp of a river in the mind. High hillside of home, I'm waving from the cement center. Can you see me? All the beautiful girls in the office are laughing, and I laugh along, and all of us good people, honest and clean. And what puts the mean in some of us? Sumptuous mountain, midnight milkweed, come to the valley of neon and no crying. I've got this big city in me, pretty on fire, pretty high-wired. It's been a year since Jess died. She said, I always knew it would come down to pills in the applesauce. And the house is not haunted, nor the office. I wish they were, don't you? We were wilder before. See-through shirts and model boys and bouncers in hotel lobbies across the country. Who knew it would be so hard to live to 32? A friend says the best way to love the world is to think of leaving. We're all in trouble, you know. Piles of empty stars we've tossed aside for the immediate kiss. Push me around a bit, shake my pockets. I store everything in my mouth. I'm going to make an apple out of plastic, going to make a real star out of the apple. Then I'm going to sell it to you. I'm going to tell you it's the most important thing. I'm going to tell you I'm sorry. I'm going to crash on your communal couch of unwanted. Let's say bloom. Let's say we're a miracle of technology. It's harder not to say anything. It's all we've got. Say it. Pinch me. You're here. So am I. So there.
Oh, marketing life for those of us left. For Jess from the collection Sharks in the Rivers by Ada Limón. Oh, that's a lovely poem.
Thank you. I think she would have liked a poem that was dedicated to her that would end with, so there.
Going back to your copywriting, trying to sell things, have you found that this has helped you in your poetry, trying to push your own work?
You know, I do think it helps in some ways. I don't think I'm as put off by it as other writers might be who might think that marketing themselves is in some ways against the purity of the art form. I always think we're writing for an audience, and so I would love to get as many people in that audience as possible. I think my poems can actually reach out and help people, I hope. And so if marketing myself or putting myself out there or being on Facebook or Twitter or any of the tools that I've gained in the commercial world can help that audience meet my poetry, I think it's just benefit to all of us, at least I hope.
You're published by 3 different presses. I'm sure you brought your talents to all of them.
Yeah, they were all great presses to work with. The first one, Lucky Wreck, is on Autumn House Press, and that was my first. It was a book prize. The same year that This Big Fake World was also won a book prize. So I went from not having any books out at all and having 2 manuscripts that I was sending out at the same time. And then they actually both won a prize within the same year.
So how did winning the book prizes change your world?
It's an interesting question for a poet because when you don't have a book out, you believe that your whole life will change once you do have a book out. It's kind of like when you're not in love, you believe your entire life will be transformed into this beautiful fairy tale when you are in love. When in fact, it's still your life and you still have to get up in the morning and do the dishes and brush your teeth and make a living. And when my first book came out, Lucky Wreck, I was working for Martha Stewart and we were throwing this big event and I hadn't even had a chance to unwrap my own copy. And I hid in the kitchen and peeled back the cover of the book for the first time. And I was hiding by myself as if I was, you know, hiding my own poetry from the world while this huge party went on around me. And I was looking at the whole way it was put together and my mom's art on the cover. And, you know, I was beyond happy. But at the same time, I had to go out and make sure Martha Stewart got what she needed to make the event successful. So, yeah, you know, it did change my life, but it changed my life in the way that I was just more committed and more encouraged to keep writing and to continue doing what I'm doing when, you know, you're still always going to have to make a living and get by as well as you can in a world that doesn't always pay you for your creativity.
Exactly. Your mother's artwork is on the cover of all 3 of your books.
Yes. So far, the presses have been blown away with her work and the response to her covers has been really exciting for them too. So I'm hoping that we will continue to have that relationship where she can do the covers of my books.
Well, we haven't talked at all about your second book, This Big Fake World, which is a collection of poems all about 3 characters, a woman who works in a hardware store, mm-hmm. a man mm-hmm. in a gray suit,
yeah.
and then his buddy who writes letters to President Reagan, mm-hmm. of all people,
yes.
who's kind of a ne'er-do-well. He doesn't really have a job. He Correct. Is in the bar a lot.
Lewis.
It's really a fun read because it has a storyline mm-hmm. through it. So all the poems are connected in that way. What inspired this book?
I started writing a few series of poems after I had finished the manuscript for Lucky Wreck, and then I was really tired of talking about myself. I felt like I had done all this work with poems that were about my own memories or about my past loves or memories of the valley, etc. And I really wanted to get out of my own heart and head and write about these other characters. And so I started writing about the man in the gray suit, and I had no idea it was going to be a whole book, but suddenly it came together. And once I realized that, I just had a blast. I mean, it was such a joy to write. I locked myself in my room, listened to loud music, and wrote every single hour that I could possibly write. I was really happy that Pearl Editions chose it for the book prize because, you know, I think it's an odd little book. And I think a lot of people who maybe don't love poetry but love fiction come to it and find a lot of joy in it. And it's really about that world in our head that we create.
I think this will stick with me for quite a while, actually. The characters in here and their predicaments.
Thank you.
And then it comes to a nice ending, too.
Yeah, there's a lightness in it.
But there's a lightness in all your work, even the most serious work. You let your sense of humor come through.
Yeah, I hope so. I think the sense of humor has kept me going. And I believe that even in darkest times, there's some joy, there's some light, there's something that's making it okay. And we have to recognize that.
Yeah. Let's end on something from Sharks in the Rivers.
Yeah.
You know one I would love to hear?
Absolutely. Tell me.
It's called Overjoyed.
Overjoyed is a poem that I wrote for the Sonoma Valley, where I was born and raised. And it's a tourist town, Sonoma, that relies a lot on the wine industry. In that era, you often get groups of wine tasters, tourists that are there and are sort of wandering around drunk in the streets and having a wonderful time. And then during the season when the pyracantha berries are full of juice, you also get these birds that get drunk off these berries. So having the tourists and having the birds there, everyone sort of drunk in this joyful way, is where this poem came from. Overjoyed. What's the drunk waxwing supposed to do when all day's been an orgy of red buds on the winery's archway off Garricky Road, and it's too far to make it home, too long to fly, even as the sober crow goes? What's the point of passion when the pyracantha berries keep the blood turned toward obsess, obsess? Don't you know those birds are going to toss themselves to the streets for some minor song of happiness? And who can blame them? This life is hard. And let me be the first to admit, when I come across some jewel of pleasure, I too want to squeeze that thing until even its seedy heart evaporates like ethanol. Want to throw my bird bones into the brush fire until, half blind, all I can hear is the sound of wings in the relentlessly delighted air.
Overjoyed, from the book Sharks in the Rivers by Ada Limon, who visited Kansas City's Public Library as part of Park University's 2011 Ethnic Voices series. Ada Limon now lives and writes in Kentucky and will be reading with many notable poets, including her teacher Philip Levine, at the 2012 Dodge Poetry Festival. For links, visit our website, newletters.org/radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thanks to Annie Walsh, Rachel Sweet, and Stephanie Hughes for production help. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.